This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
To partake in this Taste of the Caribbean today. I want to tell you that you will also be able to get another Taste of the Caribbean tomorrow outside of Gillette House at noon. If you like the music that we were playing, we will also be playing that music and more tomorrow, both Caribbean and African music, at noon tomorrow outside of Gillette House.
Mention the food.
Add the food, because we don't want it to go to waste. There will also be Jamaican food, so come enjoy at noon tomorrow. So as Joelle said, I am Ifeoma Wampo, Associate Professor in the Department of English here at Vanderbilt, and I welcome you to tonight's installment of International Lens. International Lens tonight will be seeing through a Caribbean lens, which is distinctive. On behalf of the sponsors and co-organizers of this event, I welcome you, Dean Frank Weislow, Joelle from the Office of Arts and Creative Engagement, Frank Dobson from the Black Cultural Center and Gillette House. Welcome you here tonight. I also greet you tonight with these words from the iconic Barbadian poet, Edward Kamau Brathwaite. So you have seen them with their cardboard grips, felt hats, rain cloaks, the women with their plain or purple-tinted coats hiding their fattened hips. These are the emigrants. On seaport quays, at airports, anywhere where there is a ship or train, swift motor car or jet to travel faster than the breeze. His visual verses capture what is perhaps the defining reality of Caribbean life historically and presently, and perhaps forever: emigration. The barrel, the container through which individuals abroad send goods back to their families, is a fundamental event of British Caribbean popular culture and iconography. The terms brincando el charco, are jumping the puddle, and el guagua aireo, the air minibus, or the air van, have become shorthand ways of talking about Puerto Rican physical and cultural travel between island and mainland. Black British cultural studies, a field largely created by British Caribbean descended people, has exponentially increased the cultural currency of terms like hybridity and the Black Atlantic. So largely left out of this burgeoning discourse, however, is intra-Caribbean migration, migration between the countries of the region. Our guest tonight, through the medium of film, has powerfully intervened in this externally oriented discourse, reminding everyone that it's the center-periphery binary, the notion of mother country and colony that dominates so much of the discourse on these countries is not enough, and leaves no room for the telling of stories that talk about lateral relationships or that talk about hierarchical relationships within the region. These relationships that are no longer supposed to exist because we are now decolonized, because we are now independent. This is what Annalee Davis's film talks about. It is my absolute honor and pleasure to introduce award-winning filmmaker and visual artist Annalee Davis and her new film, On the Map, to you this evening. There is much that I could say about Ms. Davis's many accomplishments and about the histories layered within the film, but I'm sure that you will be able to see those as you experience this visually and thematically lush film. Suffice it to say, On the Map represents a coming together of all the journeys implicit in Ms. Davis's cultural, intellectual, and artistic bloodlines. She comes to us tonight from St. George, Barbados. She earned her MFA from the Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers University. Her film, installation art, and other works have been critically acclaimed across the Atlantic world, including South Africa, Puerto Rico, France, and England. Works have included Just Beyond My Imagination, Barbados in a Nutshell, Contemporary Middle Passage, Creole Madonna, and Creole Chant. The film itself is a result of the meeting of Davis, whose original artistic vision, direction, and production, with her artistic vision and production, the meeting between that and that of her Cuban creative director, Omar Estrada. As you will see, the film carries within it the layered political, economic, and cultural dimensions of life of the region that are hidden from view in the Malibu rum ads that we're familiar with, in the How Stella Got Her Groove Back movies, and hidden in the hurricane tracking maps that so characterize so much of the popular discourse in the Caribbean here in the U.S. Because of the extent to which her work enriches our understanding of the complex Caribbean, because it does so as it heightens our attentiveness to forgotten dimensions of our own national reality, I am thrilled and honored to ask you to join me in welcoming Annalee Davis.
Good evening, everyone. It's a distinct pleasure to be here on this exquisitely beautiful campus. You're very blessed to be here, as I am. And of course, to thank Frank for having us to his home this evening, and Frank Dobson and Joelle and Thea and Ifoma for inviting me here. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to share my three-year project on the map with you. I'm offering this project to you from a perspective as a visual artist who is using creative imagination to understand the space in which I live and work. I work in this mode because I believe there's a potentially significant role for visual thinkers to contribute to a critical understanding of who we are in the Caribbean. I'd like to offer an introduction to On the Map by creating a bit of a context for one of the more potentially significant shifts taking place in the Caribbean. You're probably familiar with the European Union and its bringing together of a number of nations. In the Caribbean, we have something called the CARICOM single market and economy, which is an attempt to bring together a dozen nations in the Caribbean. As you probably know, the Caribbean was colonized by a number of European powers, Spain, Portugal, France, the Netherlands, England. And in the 60s, many of the Caribbean countries became independent. There have been, over the last number of decades, a number of initiatives to try and bring the region together. In 1973, we signed the Treaty of Chaguaramas, and that has been revised, and it's an attempt at making a single market and a single economy in the Caribbean. Although, from the perspective of people who are living outside, we're often seen as a very unified space within the region, there are actually lots of differences in terms of language and economics and whether there's access to natural resources, or there are many differences within the region. The film is really looking at the movement of Guyanese people into Barbados. Guyana is an English-speaking country that is located on the north coast of South America. It's a large country that experiences some of the highest emigration in the world. Barbados is a small island, 21 by 14 miles. Guyana has two major ethnic majorities. There is an Indo-Guyanese population and an Afro-Guyanese population. Barbados is largely a black population. So there are some anxieties on the part of Barbadians about Guyanese moving in to Barbados, specifically the Indo-Guyanese that are moving into Barbados. These are issues that people are grappling with all over the world. So I am really looking at focusing on a very small part of what's happening in terms of interregional migration. I've done a lot of work about migration out of the Caribbean. I've worked a lot as a visual artist producing paintings and installation work, some performance, some sound, prints and drawings. But I decided to move into the medium of film because in the last 14 years I've developed a relationship with two women in particular who migrated from Guyana into Barbados. And their lived experience and their reality on the ground was quite different from what I was hearing from the state's perspective of the interregional movement. And I found that those tensions and discrepancies were very interesting. And I felt that the need to move into film was necessary because I wanted the undocumented migrant to speak about their migrant experience. And so I worked on producing this film to allow that voice to come through. But it's not a straight documentary. It also has more lyrical and poetic moments, that interweave the voices of creative thinkers in between the migrant stories, so that there's a kind of a tension created between you know, the myth that we have about a unified region, which is debunked by the stories of Caribbean migrants exposing the fact that Caribbean people are treating other Caribbean people as an other. And so there's that sort of tension combined with more creative thinkers that are speaking about the fact that there are very deep underlying interconnectivities in the region. I have been showing the film over the last 10 months in a variety of countries, and I often document, as we are this evening, the discussion that follows a screening with the audience. I'm very curious to know how different the response will be in North America versus the readings that I've had in the Caribbean. And there's an anthropologist who's doing a critical reading of all of these recordings and transcriptions, and we're trying to get our finger on the pulse of what the issues are that are coming up over and over again in the Caribbean. It's a huge shift that could potentially take place, but what's happening with the migration movement or the integration movement is that it's functioning more for the skilled professional business classes. These are the people that are able to access the skilled certificates in order to move. The people at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder who were the original integrationists are not able to access that free movement. So there is a tension where you have people that are moving from failing economies into what they perceive as more successful economies in an event to improve their livelihood. I mean, this is why people move. Generally, people don't want to move, but they're forced into situations. And one of the reasons for making the film is not just to, you know, isolate the migrant as the problem, but to understand that governments are complicit in governing societies that are being seen by some people as failing economies, and that, you know, people are moving because they feel they don't have much of a choice. I guess I refer to this as my back chat to the state. It's a form of creative agitation that says that this isn't good enough and that we deserve better, and that the only way to be able to force change, to, you know, agitate for change, is to do things like this, which you intervene into the social space and force the dialogue takes place and put these things on the agenda so that we can continue to have dialogue about these discussions. And I think one of the roles that creative artists can take on is to create alternate visions that are hopeful or have different ways of looking at things, so that we can begin to visualize that there's another possibility. My training as a visual artist is obvious in the film. I am not trained as a filmmaker. And I think that the ways in which some of the migrants are framed is in an attempt to reframe the way in which we see them. I don't think that I should really speak too much more about it. I just wanted to give just a bit of a context so you would understand and be able to grapple with the context that the film is coming out of. But I would be very interested in engaging in dialogue with you after, and, you know, happy to answer any of your questions. So I think
he'll start. You can.
He'll start.
I told him you don't have to talk.
Projects like this are require teamwork, and I worked with three Cubans on the project. Omar Estrada was my DP and my editor, and the music was composed by David Alvarez, who is the director of an orchestra in Havana, and a musician. He can play every instrument known to man. And he spoke no English, and I spoke very little Spanish, and I was trying to explain to him what these various places felt like and what I wanted him to, you know, to do with the music. And the animator was another Cuban, Henry Enrique Garcia. So it was a collaboration between the four of us. If there are any questions or comments that anyone would like to make.
At the end, you said that I was still an educated workforce left. It's not just the question, but where did they go?
A lot of the migration, there's been a lot of research done on migration out of the Caribbean from the 50s to the United Kingdom and then into the United States and Canada. So a lot of the migration has happened to developed countries. But there is migration that's happening within the Caribbean. Sometimes it's a stepping stone. So people might move from Guyana to Barbados, for example, and then a few years later they might move to Brooklyn. So a lot of it does go out to developed countries, first world countries, but there is some happening within the Caribbean.
I'd like to comment. And my name is Michelle Houston. I'm a research associate at Tennessee State University. And I'm from Barbados. And I've had the unique experience of having worked as an immigration officer there, and then migrating to Trinidad to go to school, and then going to St. Vincent to work, and then going back to Barbados, and seeing over time exactly what you have represented there, and the shift that came within more recent years of the Indo-Guyanese persons to Barbados. And it's just very curious to me that how in Barbados, or rather, maybe I should ask you this question. In your research, did you find that there was a significant difference in attitude towards the Indo-Guyanese within the last few years compared to what it was before?
Huge. Huge. There is so much anxiety about the Indians moving to Barbados. And I mean, I think that the Indo-Guyanese have come in for a particular kind of discrimination, but I think it's become more vitriolic in the last couple of years. There are a couple of underground blogs, the Underground Press and the Barbados Free Press, and people write mostly under a pseudonym there, but they're not holding back anything, and it's really very frightening to read the language that's coming out of these blogs. It reminds you of something that's rooted in the supremacist language that came out of the United Kingdom and the US in the 60s and the 70s, and it's very, very frightening. Since the production, some of the people I've interviewed have told me that they have witnessed scenes on buses in Barbados where black Barbadian labor has got onto the bus. There's been no room to sit down. They've seen Indo-Guyanese sitting on the bus, and they, you know, say they can't stand getting on the bus, and to see a set of coolies sitting down when they have to stand up, they're being pushed into the back of the bus. The first migrant that spoke said that many times when he walks into Bridgetown, he was told, if I only knew your name, I could call immigration and make $75 on your head. Now, I have not been told that that is an official policy of the Immigration Department, but it is a sentiment that's put out there. And it makes me think of a contemporary slave catcher poster, which is a very cynical thing to say, but you're seeing women in burqas at the bus stop and saris. This is something quite unusual in Barbados. Trinidad and Guyana have two ethnic majorities, or large East Indian populations in both of those countries. It's not that way in Barbados. And I think that there is legitimate fear and concern because it's strange and people don't understand. So there, people feel that it's legitimate to have this fear. But I think transnational spaces are here to stay, and that we need to manage the situation and create education and have discussion about these issues, because a lot of the discussion isn't going very far. People are saying these very xenophobic and racist things, but it's not going much further than that. And so I mean, I almost feel that we're at a state where the government needs to step in and say this kind of language that's being used is inappropriate. Some of it happens at the border. You must have had quite an amazing kind of experience in your work. But some of it happens at the border, as Rahim Baka spoke about, you know, these incidents of people being turned away. So I think that is becoming worse, because Barbados sees its, you know, every country has a mythology, and Barbados sees itself as a homogenous black space. And so having this Indo element come in is quite frightening to a lot of Barbadians, and they're seeing racial tensions in Trinidad and Guyana, and they feel they don't want to import it. So yes, that's definitely happening. There's a quote that I wanted to read from Paul Gilroy that I was thinking about, you know, in the last couple of days. We need to consider whether the scale upon which sameness and difference are calculated might be altered productively so that the strangeness of strangers goes out of focus and other dimensions of basic sameness can be acknowledged and made significant. And I thought about it while I was here because I've noticed that for Caribbean people, we tend to feel very Caribbean people, very Caribbean outside of the Caribbean. So we arrive somewhere else and, you know, there's a Trini or a Jamaican or a Vincentian and it's all, you know, we're connected. But we don't seem to have been able to have nurtured that level of solidarity within the Caribbean. And so it's an interesting kind of question. How can we nurture our solidarity within the Caribbean that comes so easily to us when we're somewhere else?
Do you see the same resistance to trouble within different countries? Are you different islands? Are you St. Vincent's, St. Vincent's, St. Lucia's, or just is Asian, Guyanese?
I think it's something that we've seen throughout the Caribbean. I mean, there's been issues with between the Dominican Republic and the Haitians, between the Jamaicans and the Haitians. There's these problems in the Turks and Caicos. I mean, you know, there was that, you know, there were problems with Haitians that the word Parsley, mm-hmm. you know, if you couldn't pronounce Parsley in a convincingly, you know, local way, your tongues were cut out. I mean, this was in the 30s, I think. This is not peculiar to Barbados and Guyana. This is something that's happening all over the world. This is not something that's even a Caribbean problem. We've seen it, you know, with the Serbs and the Bosnians, or we've seen it with in Rwanda, or, you know, we're seeing it in the United Kingdom. I was telling Ifoma today that the BBC put out a program trying to deal with this issue of white English people feeling marginalized because of migrants, but it's, you know, they're Polish people that are coming in, or, you know, Romanians. There's a problem of the Turkish Muslims in Germany. So it's this is how human beings behave, I guess.
But truly, I think what you said, when the Indo-Guyanese population became the majority population, and a similar thing happened in Trinidad and Tobago, Trinidad mostly than Tobago. Those tensions began, that the blacks started to be marginalized. And I think it's embarrassing to me, and it's stunned when I listen and watch but that fear, the uncertainty, the seeing what has happened in the other countries, and you know, my father owns a farm, and the only people that we could get to work on the farm are the Guyanese, the Indo-Guyanese. And we can't get work permits for them. And so you put a house up on the land and you hide it behind some sugar cane and you let the people work and you pay them and you hope that they don't get anybody upset. And because one thing that came out in your film is that the skilled persons are able to move across the Caribbean boundaries. It took nothing for me to be able to go and work in on the island of St. Vincent. However, the labor force that is required to do the construction and the farming and the you know, fill those jobs that Barbadians only work, those are still being left vacant. And we see the same thing happening here in the United States of America. I mean, you know, you talked about what's happening to the Turkish Muslims in Germany and stuff like that. But the Mexican Americans are coming here, and people are starting to get, I mean, Mexicans and the Latino population is growing here, people are starting to get scared. And I think that one of the interesting things is the lack of education and the lack of understanding. And I think the government of Barbados can, as you say, fulfill a greater role. You know, can I share an experience?
Yes, please.
I was an immigration officer, and someone called to report that this person was, you know, she was illegal, she was creating a fuss and stuff. So we drove down to St. Lucie, 3:00 a.m. as investigators, and we knocked on the door, just like you described, And here was this woman who had come in from, in this case, she was from St. Vincent. And she was working on a farm. And she was contributing, and she was sending back money. And this little old lady must have been about 65 years old, not a harm to anybody, but someone called to report her. My goodness, what, you know, you get caught in that. She's just working. But we have to arrest her. And, you know, I said to the lady, here's what we can do. Pack your things, we're going to take it down to the port. We're going to ship you out and have someone make it at your house. The little old lady jumped through the window in fear and took off running in the bush. End of story. She was arrested, taken, shipped out, deported, lost everything actually. Not an isolated case. It happened so many times. The prostitutes coming in, very good depiction of what. But I think that what has happened is that the fear that is under that baseline, underlying fear that Barbadians have about these people coming in to take their jobs is not being alleviated, because we are not going in to cut canes, I'm telling you that. We are not going to cut canes, just as much as black folks here are not going to pick cotton. You understand what I mean? I mean, and that might sound cruel and ugly and harsh, but that's the reality. But yet we're still scared, and we're still saying they're coming to take our jobs. They're not coming to take our jobs in Barbados. They're coming to do jobs we don't want and help their families back home. Because people like us, we're the brain drain. We get our free education, and then we ship off. And it's embarrassing, but that's the reality. Thanks for bringing that up.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah, I mean, everything you're saying is true. Thank you for sharing that.
Where are they at instituting this Article 45, and are any of the governments doing anything to look at the social impacts of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, the migrants are really out there on their own, and I think that's one of the problems, because, you know, when you make the migrant the problem, it relieves the responsibility of the state of providing the social services. And so they say, well, we're not quite ready to fully integrate because we don't have the social services in place where we can share the national insurance scheme and, you know, all of the services that we want to be able to allow them to have access to. But I think there was a heads of government meeting in Antigua in July, and we were supposed to have a completion date for this by 2015, because they've had a phased approach where they would allow, at this point, if you're a musician, an athlete, an artist, a journalist, a media worker, a teacher, or a nurse, or a university graduate, you can apply for a skills certificate and move throughout the Caribbean. They have added domestic worker, and now they've kind of separated it. So it means that it's functioning for banks and insurance companies, and that they can move their personnel throughout the region. But the original integrationists were the hucksters, the women that you know, the market women that traveled on the boats, or even the small planes moving their pineapples and mangoes and bananas. And these people at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder are not allowed to move. And I think that, you know, these migrants who are Caribbean people should not be looked at largely as units of labor. They're human beings. And the Caribbean is made up of movement. It's not defined by borders. And so when these heads of governments met in July, and we were supposed to move towards a 2015 deadline for everything implemented, they wanted to push it back further. And that's what they keep doing. They keep pushing it back. And I'm now of the opinion that I'm not sure that we're ever going to have full integration or free movement for all Caribbean nationals, because, you know, I just don't see that there's the political will to do it. We've just signed yesterday an agreement with the Europeans, the Economic Partnership Agreement, which is supposed to be based on reciprocity of economies between 12 small CARICOM countries. Versus Europe, a population of over 300 million. And it's functioning for the larger businesses. It's not functioning for people at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder who are the scaffolding of the community, who are building, who are doing the work. So I'm not seeing right now, with the leaders we have in the Caribbean, I'm not seeing that there's a political will to move towards educating people about this enormous shift, resolving the tensions and the issues. I'm not seeing it.
I was wondering, watching the film, about the text on the map. I mean, because on the one hand, what's on the map is, at the very end, build, sort of a Caribbean space that actually doesn't exist, that one gentleman at the end said, in our heads, although it in some senses exists. And then there's so much in the film, and also in the discussion, that there's so many people here that the last thing they want to do is be on the map, in a sense, right? So people who are talking into corners because they can't have their faces shown. That you know, wonderful but sort of pathetic woman in a shroud.
Yeah.
In fact, in many ways, since if you listen to the discussion, so many people across the world have to operate in such a way that they avoid being on the map, because to be on the map basically means to be subjected to the immigration officer. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, since you're the filmmaker and I just have an obsession with titles ultimately. whether you know
why that title.
Yeah.
I had initially thought of Off the Map, and we did a search on it, and there was a film already called Off the Map that was about to do with drugs. And then I thought, well, On the Map, because I'm actually trying to put these people on the map. They live under the radar. I mean, a lot of these people are working 7 days a week, and they live like rats in a hole, many of them living in, you know, subhuman conditions, working for less. I mean, that man who hadn't been home to see his son for 6 years. And so I felt that the film was putting these people on the map. It was putting their image on the screen. It is putting the issue on the table. And it's bringing greater awareness to the topic. And, you know, if I could stamp something in their passport that would allow them to move. So the idea of putting them on the map was about making them feel legitimate, because the two men who were speaking with in silhouette were documented, but they felt they didn't feel legitimate. They had papers, but they didn't feel that they could be shown because they were petrified. And the first guy actually returned to Guyana. He referred to himself as the family sacrificial lamb who was sent at 18 to pay off the loan for the mother's house and to put the two girls through school. And he didn't like it, and he returned to Guyana a year ago, and, you know, he referred to himself as a sacrificial lamb. And I just felt they needed to be put on the map, and they needed to be seen and reframed in a different way than how we normally see them and think about them, in a more gracious and dignified and beautiful way, which was what I was trying to do, given the restriction of having to conceal their identity, and therefore the use of the mosquito netting and,
It's striking watching your film to just reflect on traveling around the world and how often, in fact, you don't notice what you saw in your film, and just in reflecting on those travels and how, in fact, you did notice it, but yet, whether it be immigration officers or people who were traveling and plainly traveling from place to place in ways that you, as a member of the first world, are certainly not.
Yeah.
It's striking.
I mean, it's... That you know, Barbados has a little bit of a reputation of, they refer to something called a bench that they put a lot of Guyanese to sit on, and now in the new airport there's a room, and if you look, you sometimes see it, you know. So yeah, it's frightening how some of these people have to try and move through, and you know, I just maintain that it is so disappointing that, you know, people feel that independence has been a lie in some ways, because, you know, 40 years into independence, you know, decades ago, you know, I've been speaking recently at a lot of these academic conferences to older scholars and academics who felt that when they were going to the University of the West Indies in the 60s and 70s, they were really contributing to building nations and to a unification of the region, and there was this great excitement. And here we are 40 years later, where there's there's mass migration. The economies are failing, and we're having a very difficult time looking honestly at our societies and speaking about that. And there's a respected thinker out of Trinidad, Lloyd Best, who died a couple of years ago, an economist, and he spoke about the fact that the Caribbean is one of the places that, one of the only places in the world where the economy happened first. Everywhere else, the society happens, and you develop an economy, and you export your products. But in the Caribbean, the economy was built, and the labor was imported to fuel that economy. And so you have a very complicated kind of hybridized space where your labor force and your population are brought in. And now all these years later, we're trying to build a home. And to me, the CSME is about Caribbean people building a home, owning the Caribbean, not being owned by it, developing a community that we can live in and grow in and raise our children in and not run from. And that is the significance of the CSME. And the politicians are not reading it that way. They're looking at the Economic Partnership Agreement and the CSME as marketplaces. So the Europeans can have access to raw materials and to a labor force, but it's not about building a community that we can live in. And when I showed this film at the Brooklyn Museum from September to January, I showed it with a piece called Just Beyond My Imagination, which is an installation that maps the Caribbean as a golf course. So the Caribbean Sea becomes astroturf and the islands become sand traps. And so there's this dichotomy of a region that is bringing in 36 million tourists annually, but having one of the highest rates of emigration in the world. And there's a real dichotomy there, a real tension between a space that we are running from and tourists are running to. And it's still not like a legitimate home that we're supposed to live and work in. So those are some of the, you know, some of the tensions in there. Any more comments or questions?
For me, it was the education of the term borders being talked about border. When they talk about islands, they're going from island to island. And borders traditionally, from my point of view, has been restricted to designate a designated or a land, you know, a non-existent but artificial constructed divisory line. And here since the border of an island, I would assume then at a port of entry, there's something by air terminal. Of course, it's a seaport. It's an interesting transposing, I guess, of an image that had not been adapted.
Thank you very much for being here this evening. It was lovely to be able to share it with you. Thank you so much.